Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can you measure quality of life across an entire city? Drive from one end of Dallas to the other, and it becomes clear quickly that conditions from one neighborhood to the next are not often equal. So while we celebrate neighborhoods with high schools that have great high SAT scores and graduation rates, those successes don't mean much to people whose kids are enrolled in low-performing schools a few miles away. The same goes for decent housing, resident wealth, and civic engagement. So a growing number of experts are also looking at the distribution of a city's best and worst elements, with the assumption that good quality of life requires certain conditions to be met regardless of zip code. Dr. Timothy Bray is director of the Institute for Urban Policy and Research at the University of Texas at Dallas. Since 2006, the Institute has published an annual Wholeness Index for the city, which uses a dozen key indicators to measure quality of life and the degree of disparity between those who live well and those who struggle. Tim, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Let's start with this. Will you give us a definition of wholeness as it applies to this index?
Sure. I think the simplest definition of wholeness to think about is that it's the opposite of disparity, which is really a simple definition and a little bit complex. I think to put it in more concrete terms, it's a sense of connectedness. It's a sense of everyone having an equal opportunity, not necessarily everybody starting on the same playing field, but having an equal chance to aspire to the same dreams and the same goals.
So that plays into what you decided should be on this index. And there are a million different things we could measure.
Right.
And basically, there are three large categories that you look at.
Right. And what we did was we began talking with folks in the community, folks who live in neighborhoods. You pointed out that there's a number of definitions, and the academic literature is replete with numerous ways to measure safety and numerous ways to measure economic disparity. What we wanted to get was those indicators that people would relate to, the things that people would say, yes, this is why I live here and this is what I celebrate about my neighborhood. So we began by talking with residents, and we must have come up with 30 or 40 things that were on the list. Some of them you would expect to be sort of the usual culprits. Others were a lot harder to measure, things like, well, the quality of the grocery stores that are in my neighborhood. How do you measure the quality of a grocery store, right? That would be a whole other a set of research. So we went back from this list of 40. We went back into the academic literature and found the things that other folks had done in other cities that could be replicated here and that seemed to make a lot of sense, that the research showed, yeah, these things are connected to one another and they do make a difference in quality of life. So we wound up with what are essentially 12 indicators that we call a pointer system. You know, the notion of the index is that it's not supposed to be the one number that tells you we're doing great or we're not. These are not the only 12 things that matter, but chances are if you're in a neighborhood where the schools aren't performing as well as you'd like them to be, there's other things about education, not even in the public school system, other things about the availability of educational opportunities perhaps that are also not where you want them to be. So we look at the Wholeness Index as a way of capturing just those 12 crystal clear salient points about quality of living in a neighborhood that let us then dig deeper. If we find a neighborhood that's not performing where residents would want it to be, we now know which areas we need to look in.
So one of the things that you look at is you were talking about education, and there are three really key components. One is how many people are willing to have their kids, people who could afford to put their kids in private school, how many kids are people are willing to put their kids in public school?
Right. So we call that school holding power. And it's probably the most abstract measure that we use. It's the most computed, I should say. Because in the end, it's a personal choice that people make. And there's no national database of who chose to go to public schools and why, and was it an affordability issue or was it lack of faith in a school district? So we begin by simply looking at how many kids are above the poverty line in a school and how many kids live in the neighborhood of that school who are above the poverty line. And the idea is simply that folks who could afford to send their kids elsewhere might not if they perceived that the public school in their neighborhood was a suitable educational investment for their kids. So again, the Wholeness Index is a relative measure. We don't know that a gap of 50% or 10% or 12% is the magic bullet. We just know that it differs from neighborhood to neighborhood, and we would want to close that gap. Whatever it is, we don't know what the final number should be, but in some neighborhoods, we're looking at 70%, a difference of 70 percentage points between the what we call the middle class and middle class children living in a neighborhood and the kids in middle class status in the school.
So, in other words, that difference of 70% means there are some neighborhoods where an overwhelming number of people feel like they have a safe school to send their kids to, and there are other neighborhoods where an overwhelming number of people feel like that is not an option.
And it may not be a dimension of safety. It may be a number of dimensions. It may simply be, you know, I don't believe that the school system is teaching what I want my kids to learn. We don't know what that dimension is because we haven't asked. And a lot of it then is also people's perceptions, which may or may not be correct. What I will tell you, if you look at the maps in the Wholeness Index, is the neighborhoods where folks are sending their kids to public schools in larger number are not necessarily the ones where you'd expect that to be happening. For instance, in South Dallas, which gets a lot of bad rap and a lot of bad press, one of their elementary schools is one of the top performing schools in the district. It was one of the first schools to have 100% of their third graders pass the tax test on the first try. Those parents know that, and they know that that's one stable institution in their community they can count on where kids are getting the services that they need. So it really does tend to line up with what people expect of their schools. But that puts an onus, I think, on the districts, on teachers, to really help people with understanding what those expectations should be. A lot of times we suffer from a misperception of how good a school is. And to some extent, too, we see that happen with the district where, you know, something happens with the district and all of the schools are cast in a bad light. But we have some excellent teachers in DISD teaching in some excellent schools. Folks on the ground know that. We need to find it at an administration level. How do we help manage that so that people can learn what's going on good in the district?
And I have to imagine some of that snowballs in one direction or the other. Either people suddenly think a school is okay and they'll start sending their kids there, or conversely, they'll decide somehow if enough people have pulled out that they can't possibly consider it.
Yeah, and that's the trouble. You know, again, the Wholeness Index is a pointer system. We don't go that deep into it. I think that would be a fantastic line of academic research. What is the critical mass that happens? And again, if you go back to some of the literature on economic decision-making and how people make those decisions based on their perceptions, we'll find that that's a lot of the answer in our schools and in our neighborhood choices is helping people get to the nut of what's really going on.
Dr. Timothy Bray is my guest. He's director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy Research. We're talking about the 2008 Dallas Wholeness Index. One number that might take people by surprise, although it's been pretty consistent over the years, is crime.
Right.
Crime is not far worse in one particular neighborhood than another. In fact, it's the most whole of the things that you look at.
Right. We get wholeness from one basic point. If everyone's alike, our wholeness score would be 100. If everybody's the exact polar opposite of one another, we would have a wholeness score of 0. One of the things that happens with crime, and again, this gets to that notion of aggregation, where the city releases its aggregate crime rate, and you know, a couple of years ago, we were the most dangerous city, you know, on the planet, if you believe the publishers of that report, which has a lot of faulty methodology in it. But the bottom line is that's a perception issue then. And what happens is there's neighborhoods in Dallas, there's neighborhoods in the northern and southern sector that don't have crime rates that are all that different from Plano, Frisco, Cedar Hill. We have a couple of neighborhoods that have extremely bad crime rates, and the types of crimes in those neighborhoods are quite different from one another. So we have a pocket in South Dallas where the crime rate averages about 4 times what we see, and the same is true in an area of northwest Dallas up along Northwest Highway and Texas Stadium, where we see crime rates that are 4 to 6 times, in some cases even higher than the city average. Those numbers are driving what goes on in the rest of the city, especially from a perception standpoint.
So the kinds of crimes that are measured here are index crimes.
Right.
What you're not looking at are the things that sometimes people use to tell them if a neighborhood is good or bad, things like graffiti and vandalism.
Right, and public order issues. There's a couple of reasons for that. So one of the big shortcomings of crime data is you really only know the things that are reported well. One of the best reported crimes that are out there is auto theft, because to get your car replaced, the police, the insurance company wants you to have a crime report. Homicide tends to be fairly well reported because it's kind of hard to remove the evidence, right? And it's a very difficult crime to cover up. But when we start looking at other index crimes like burglary, there are some neighborhoods that are disinvested from the police department, from city government, where if somebody comes and takes the bike from your front yard, it doesn't rise to a level they're going to call the police department and report a theft. So we have that issue in the index crimes themselves. Other crimes often only get reported when the police make an arrest. So if you look at things like prostitution and vice, if I call and I report that I suspect seeing someone engaged in a drug transaction, that may not generate a police report unless they show up and they make an arrest. So we want to be very careful to not let the wholeness index reflect police reporting practices and those sorts of things. Now, we do have a very interesting project that we're engaging in now in some neighborhoods. We call it a windshield survey. And in this windshield survey, trained evaluation teams will drive through a neighborhood and begin looking at these sorts of signs of physical decay. Graffiti you mentioned I think is particularly important because it's incumbent that we not just say, hey, somebody painted on a wall. We have to capture whether or not that's reviewed by the residents as a piece of public art. And think about Deep Ellum. It would be very easy for somebody to come in with a big old bucket of white paint and say, look at all this horrible graffiti. We've got to cover it up. But it actually has a cultural value. So from a standpoint of wanting to respect the cultures that live in different neighborhoods and respect those things that other neighborhoods value, we can't just go through and label and say this is graffiti. Now, we do look at things like structural deficiencies in houses, meaning is there a house that's about to fall down? We're not out measuring the level of the door or anything like that. But also other things like high weeds. So some signs of what we might call civil decline, right? This notion of folks wanting to move into a neighborhood and being dissuaded, not by the crime rate, which they probably don't even know, but by those minor signs, those, geez, you know, the houses don't look like they've had a fresh coat of paint, or the weeds in my neighbor's house are kind of grown up. And those are, you know, really qualitative judgments that people are making in the back of their mind.
Another thing that you look at, and I guess this is related, is fit housing, meaning mm-hmm. housing that is safe and adequate for the people who live there.
Exactly. Fit housing is an important measure because and I think it goes hand in hand with what we call in the index middle class affordable housing. The notion is that in order for us to attract folks to either move into the city, but more importantly, this is an important dimension for fit and middle class housing, folks who may have started out in an affordable housing unit in the city and they've gotten their college degree or they've finished high school and they've gotten a job and they want to move up. Maybe they've gotten married and now they want to start looking for a 3-bedroom house. You can't find one, right? And so here are some families who may want to stay in the city of Dallas and wind up moving to Mesquite or moving to Garland or moving to Lancaster. So the availability of affordable housing, but also fit housing, housing that's in good shape. For both of those, we rely on kind of the professional side of the data that rates houses as are they fit. Essentially, our definition of fit is any house that's ranked average or above.
In terms of quality.
In terms of quality, right. And you can get down to poor and obsolete. The fact that we've drawn the bar so low to get a house in as a fit house and you still see concentrations in some neighborhoods really starts to speak to what are the things we should be doing. A few years back, we did an analysis that said, well, okay, the city's lacking an affordable housing stock. What would happen if we came in and just repaired the houses that were unfit? And Dallas has such a lack of affordable middle-class homes that even if we took every house that was unfit and put enough money into it to raise it to a fit-level house – And it suddenly would sell for that price, we still wouldn't have. In some cases, even if we took some of the unfit homes and put enough money in them to raise them to a fit level, they're still selling at a very, very, very low price rate. One of the common observations is there are quote-unquote affordable homes in Dallas. In a number of the neighborhoods that we're looking at in parts of the northern and southern sector, you can get a house and the lot it sits on for $25,000. But if you're wanting to raise a family and you've grown up in South Dallas and it's time now you want to buy a bigger house, you want to buy a 3-bedroom house, you're not looking for that $25,000 home that's going to take $50,000 worth of repairs.
We are talking about the 2008 Dallas Wholeness Index with Dr. Timothy Bray. He's director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy and Research. We'd love for you to join our conversation. You can do so by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Dr. Timothy Bray. He's director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy and Research. They have just released the 2008 Dallas Wholeness Index, and tomorrow they will have an annual conference from 8 to 4 at the Dallas Convention Center. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It's pretty obvious, Tim, that people who are in an area that is not doing well will be motivated to change or interested in how we can change things. How do we get those who are doing well engaged in neighborhoods that they might not have reason in their minds to ever even travel through?
Yeah, I think that's an important concept, and it gets back to this notion of wholeness. One of the things that we draw folks' attention to is that whether or not we believe we're related and interrelated to one another, we are. James Washington did a fantastic quote when he chaired our luncheon panel at last year's conference. He said, you know, I can take no solace in the fact that your end of the boat has a hole in it, which is a fantastic way of looking at, you know, sort of the sense that we're all in it together. So I mean, I can give you an example. My predecessor, Dr. Marcus Martin, had started this line of research that was looking at what it costs the public to pay the healthcare costs of folks who are involved in non-fatal gunshot wounds. And the vast majority of folks who suffer from non-fatal gunshot wounds are uninsured, which means it's a public health cost. And that's money we don't have a choice about. We have to pay that bill. But what if we could take that amount of money and invest it in education programs and safety programs and a variety of those things up front? Even if we took half of that money, what's the impact that we would have on the back end? And that's an everybody issue, right? That is not a your neighborhood, my neighborhood, because we're all footing that bill. The same thing is true for economic vitality. What the economic research shows is that cities and regions that aren't connected to one another, cities where you have wide disparities and you have us versus them mentalities and you have that neighborhood and my neighborhood mentalities, that is a tremendous impediment to them actually prospering together. We're all stronger together than we are by ourselves. And this is true from a community dynamic standpoint as well. From an educational standpoint, if we're not investing in the education of our children, 168,000 children who go to Dallas ISD, those kids are going to work in the factories, lead the companies, run the future in this city. Most of them stay in Dallas. And so it's incumbent upon us, all of us, to recognize, you know, the old joke is these are the kids who are going to be paying, you know, this is going to be my doctor 10 years from now when I need surgery. Well, that's all of us. That's not my neighborhood or your neighborhood. So we start looking at things like how we make public infrastructure decisions, how we decide where businesses should be located, not just because it helps your neighborhood or my neighborhood, but because it becomes a tool for us to engage in economic development that spurs minds and it spurs the future of children and the future of families.
To what extent do people relate to others as neighbors depending on geography as opposed to socioeconomic factors and racial and ethnic identity?
There's a lot of academic research into how we make this decision about who we are. I began my career when I started working on my doctoral dissertation looking at differences in crime rates between neighborhoods from a theoretical position of social disorganization theory, which kind of has a bad – it kind of has a bad name, but it simply suggests that if a community can't come together and decide on what its shared values are and decide on how it's going to teach the kids and pass those messages along – well, then you have a hard time, you know, as a group, as a society, regulating folks' behavior. So I began looking at that, and one of the questions we began asking was, well, how do you define a neighborhood? A colleague of mine, a fellow grad student, said, Tim, when I go out and stand on my front porch, I'm in the middle of my neighborhood. I don't believe in these lines, right? I just heard a comedian in the car on the way over. He said he drove cross-country, and he couldn't find the dotted lines that are on the map. You know, Kansas isn't pink. We tend to inflect these boundaries on our world. It's a process that we do because it helps us get police places more efficiently. It helps us to decide which stores to go to. But that's an artifact. We create that. And to the extent that we begin to let that rule our viewpoint, to the extent that that sets up an us versus them mentality, and it's all over the Metroplex. I live in one of the northern suburbs, and if you're on the east side of 75, you're in this part of town. But if you're on the west side of 75, you're in the other part of town. It's the way people think. It's, you know, we make decisions, we make classifications. One of the most important things then is to look at how the decisions that we make as government, the decisions that we make as community leaders about how we build and where we build reinforces that. We're looking at that now, the HOPE 6 program from the federal government, which was designed to eliminate this notion of siloing up poor people in these large communities of affordable housing and actually allowing them to live in whatever neighborhood they want, is about that entirely. If we decide to put everybody who makes one set of income in one neighborhood and let folks who can afford to live someplace else choose to live elsewhere, that reinforces that dichotomy. I don't want to go to that part of town because that part of town is not like my part of town. And some of that's artificially constructed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jenny in Dallas. Hi, Jenny.
Actually, it's Jeannie. Hi.
Oh, Jeannie, hi.
That's okay. My question is along the lines of what type of programs are available to help encourage these quote-unquote blighted areas? I've actually been thinking about looking at that Northwest Highway area over there. I'm actually new in Dallas the last 2 years. I moved here to go to chiropractic school. And before I do that, I'm going to make a small business that can pay for school. And when I leave school, I want to actually set up my practice in the Latin American community. I'm dual citizen with Mexico. And I'm wondering what kind of programs are available to help improve these communities. Are there funds available, especially in this in these economic times?
Jeannie, that's a fantastic question. And like you, I'm new to Dallas as well. I've been here for about 6 years now. One of the things that I would encourage you to do is reach out to folks who are living in the neighborhoods that you're looking at. Reach out to some of the local businesses. The most important thing that we can do is begin to form those personal relationships. Folks will tell you the issues that they're facing. We've done some conversations in South Dallas, and you'd be surprised how often we miss the mark when we think this is what a community's concerns are. But then you start talking to the folks who live there, and you find something totally different. Or maybe the things that you identified were important, but there's a much more pressing issue, that they're not ready to talk about other things until they fix this problem with education or this problem with crime or things that they're looking at. So I think for starters, we have to be careful about what we call blight, because that's, again, something that we construct and something that we define. Now, clearly, houses that are falling down are unfit, but we were just talking off air about this notion of taking the concepts that were initially introduced in the very beginning of community policing about allowing residents to set their precedents for what types of crime should be enforced and the priority weight that should be given to them, and doing that in code enforcement. And maybe there are issues that should be focused on before we focus on this notion of physical blight. Usually what happens is that there's a vicious cycle, that neighborhoods that experience physical blight, where they have physical decay of their housing infrastructure or their civic infrastructure, they've also got other problems as well. Perhaps they're not as connected with each other as they might want to be. A lot of times, folks, they don't have time to go to community meetings. They're working two jobs. They don't have time to go to parent-teacher conferences. They're working two and three jobs. And so we have to change the way we think about relating with folks. Some of the schools now are doing this fantastic job of having teacher conferences in the evening, right? 20 years ago, that was unheard of. You just need to find a way to get off work and come and participate. Well, now we're talking about how do we reflect this difference. So I think that one of the things I would encourage you to do is also talk to the Dallas Concilio of Hispanic Services. They do a lot of work in neighborhoods around Dallas and would be aware of specific programs. One of the things that happens, and this may or may not be applicable to you in your degree of study, but there are federal agencies who are giving grants to folks who graduate with their advanced degrees, whether it's in graduate school or professional degrees, and go back and give in communities that are either identified as having high levels of poverty or particular health issues. I know this is something they're doing in the fields of public health. So I would encourage you to follow that route as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're talking about the 2008 Dallas Wholeness Index with Dr. Tim Bray. He's director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy and Research. Let's speak next to John in Louisville. Hello, John.
Howdy.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, doctor, I'm against the, first I would just give me an example of a successful government managed housing project, number one. Number two, on the heels of that, why do we need the government involved in housing? Right now we've got the government involved in our economy. That's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. But I just don't see, I haven't seen much success in government housing, and I'm not sure what would be defined as success. So, I'll let you address that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, John, I appreciate that. That's an important question, is what the role of the federal government is. One of the things that people are advancing in notion now is that housing should be considered to some degree like infrastructure. We don't have a problem with government coming through and saying this is where we should allow highways to be and this is how they should be routed. We don't always do that as efficiently as we can, and we don't always rely on other modes of transportation, but we've at least accepted the fact that there needs to be some degree of coordination among people. Now, this is not to say that government should or shouldn't come out and say who can build what where, but access to affordable, quality housing is a key ingredient to the livelihood of the community. If we continue to build new homes in some neighborhoods and allow other neighborhoods to decay, simply driven by market forces, eventually we'll see situations like we have in Detroit. The first businesses to move out of Detroit proper were the grocery stores. And once the grocery stores went, we began to see other retail secede out of the city. Once that happened, folks who may have wanted to stay in Detroit, now they can't shop anyplace. And now they begin looking at other options. So it's a delicate balance. And I would be probably the first to say I don't know that we've ever gotten it right so far. But that doesn't mean that the answer is to shut it off. I think we have to give some serious thought to how it should work and what the appropriate role is.
It is really interesting that you talked earlier a little bit, touched on this, the fact that you included access to retail, because the grocery store question is a huge one, I think, for a lot of people, but it doesn't show up in a lot of other places.
Right. And, one of the things that we've repeatedly heard from folks when they tell us that the issues that they believe they're facing in their community that affect quality of life, it's access to good, affordable, and healthy food choices. This is not a new line of research. Public health has been looking in this area for some number of years at the fact that in some neighborhoods, when you have an area that's dominated by fast food markets and corner convenience stores, those foods tend to be less health conscious. They tend to be higher in fat. They tend to be higher in carbohydrates. They tend to be higher in cholesterol. And it's no surprise from a public health perspective that in these neighborhoods, we also see high levels of diabetes and high levels of cardiovascular disease. These are preventable diseases that are killing thousands of people every year. So one approach to that is looking at where we put our grocery stores. One of the things that we see is that, whether you like big box store mentality or not, they have a much better price point at being able to bring in fresh groceries, at being able to bring in fresh meat, fresh produce, and fresh dairy, which are key ingredients. Getting there is an issue. We did some research the end of last year, and what it showed was that in the southern sector, the number of neighborhoods that had a grocery store at least 1 to 3 miles away was almost double what it was in the northern sector. And the big issue there is, my first response was, well, it's just a mile. And then it struck me, well, try walking it and try walking with food for six people. Take the bus. Okay, it's a mile away. It's a 40-minute bus ride. Those are serious implications for folks who might then decide, well, I'll just stop at the corner grocery store and we'll get something that we can cook tonight. One of my first experiences in Dallas when I began working with the Institute was to take a drive through some of these neighborhoods that, as you pointed out earlier, Chris, I would never have had occasion to visit before. And there are stores that are selling Pampers by the pamper. And I've never had in my life, I've got four kids, and I've never had to make the decision, do I want to buy a pamper or do I want to buy food, right? Now it's more affordable because I can buy one. The stores that are making those types of sales, right, these neighborhood grocers, they're both a blessing, but they're also in part the problem. They are smaller. They can't afford necessarily to bring all the healthy options in. But I'll tell you, we heard from folks in the neighborhood who said, when I don't get my paycheck, this store gives me credit. The big box supermarket a mile away doesn't know who I am. They're not going to say, I tell you what, we know you're good for the money, so next month come in and pay us for this month's groceries. So it's a really delicate balance to try and look at.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Effie in Dallas. Hi, Effie.
Hi. I wanted to comment on what your speaker is saying. By the way, I've really enjoyed your show today.
Thank you.
I live in the southern sector. And when I've been here approximately 14 years, and I really became aware of how Dallas is divided in every aspect. He's right on target. When if you live in, say, the northern part of Dallas, you might have better access to things, be it food, be it shopping, be it medical, for sure, not to mention mental health. It's just amazing how different it is all across the city. And when you have organizations advocating for different things, they will say that it's for the region. But in most cases, south of the Trinity, they don't see these things coming to fruition. And I think that's really a sad thing, not only for the city of Dallas, but for the southern suburbs as well. As you said, there's a huge population in the southern suburbs now who don't have access to a lot of the things that are available in various areas in this metroplex. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks very much for calling. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I think Effie makes a very good point. You know, if you just carved out of Dallas the southern sector, you would have more people than live in many North American cities. We're talking about close to 500, almost 600,000 people. That's larger than the city of St. Louis, where I grew up. It's shocking. I do this experiment with folks. We'll drive up 75 about a mile, mile and a half, and we'll drive down 45 about a mile, mile and a half, and you would never believe you were still in the city of Dallas. So while in other cities you find developers chomping at the bit to take up available land, we have to ask the question in Dallas, how can this parcel of land sit a mile and a half south of Dallas and not have a bunch of people jumping up? And, you know, you start to look at the issues that drive people's perceptions, how we make those decisions, and how we truly grow together as a region.
We are talking about the 2008 Dallas Wholeness Index with Dr. Timothy Bray. He's the director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy and Research. We'll take more of your calls in just a minute. You can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the director of the UT Dallas Institute for Urban Policy and Research, Dr. Timothy Bray. The Institute will hold its annual conference tomorrow from 8 to 4 at the Dallas Convention Center. You can find information about that on our website, the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Robbie in Carrollton says, ultimately, isn't the wholeness of any given neighborhood made up of the inhabitants of that area, their habits, their attitudes about civil life, and their choices? Typically, people in blighted areas are not interested in doing better for themselves, let alone the community as a whole. Does that reflect your research?
Yeah, absolutely not. And this is an important aspect of sociology. Is that we all tend to apply our framework to the other issues that we see in life, and things don't line up. We did an extensive bit of research, a pilot project of a household survey in South Dallas. And we had, I think it was 67, 75 folks, households take this survey. One of the questions in that survey was, are you happy with your neighborhood? And these are folks who lived in a variety of conditions, some overcrowded, some in what some folks would call substandard housing. Yet almost unanimously, they had some degree of either very happy or happy with, you know, living in their neighborhood. And you'd be surprised how many people are surprised to hear that. How many folks say, well, how can that possibly be?
How would you want to be in a neighborhood that looks like this one, basically, is what people were telling you.
Right. And what's going on, frankly, is that folks who live in some neighborhoods don't want to move any more than you want to leave yours. We've all had situations in our neighborhoods where there's been a burglary or there's been a crime or the school starts performing badly. Our first inclination is not, well, it's time to move. especially not in some situations where folks have lived there for generations. These are, you know, these are the places that families call home. You don't want to just get up and leave. What happens is we don't have access to the same tools everywhere. We don't have not everybody has access to a home equity line of credit that helps kids get through school or can fix a tree that comes down in your neighborhood. Those types of, you know, basic everyday things are handled in entirely different ways based on the tool sets that you have access to. So invariably we found that folks in these neighborhoods want it made better. And more importantly, they want to be a part of making it better. And I think that's something that we very often overlook is we as do-gooders feel that we need to come in there, right? I need to come in and fix things. When we meet with community organizations, that, as we do quite regularly, what we tell folks is we can't lead your charge. I'll paint your picket signs, but I can't be in front of the charge. This is your neighborhood. If you want a grocery store here, let us help you by giving you the tools that you need to make the case. Let us help facilitate the conversations that you need to have. But I can't go tell someone they need to have groceries. I have no standing. I have no merit. This is not my neighborhood. We've never had that conversation with someone who wasn't willing to step up. There's not ever been somebody who said, well, if you're not willing to come in and do it, then it's not worth doing. Invariably, there are folks, and these are, you know, to back to a 1980s point, 1,000 points of light, they're all over South Dallas. They're all over West Dallas. They're all over Pleasant Grove. They're all over North Dallas. It's connecting people and giving them access to the tools that they need that really changes things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. What's really interesting about that sense that we all have that somebody else would want to live in our neighborhood instead of in theirs is that all the studies on human happiness, or the ones that have looked at this, say that people are satisfied with their surroundings if they feel about the same as their neighbors. But if they feel like they're not doing as well, no matter whether it's Highland Park or Pleasant Grove, then they're really unhappy with where they are.
Yeah, and wholeness is about that. Wholeness is really not about absolute levels. Wholeness is about disparity and evenness. So, you know, one of the early criticisms of the wholeness index, which I think is still valid, is we can become very, very whole in crime. We just stop policing. You know, stop policing the neighborhoods where crime is low. We could become very whole in housing. We could just not build any more houses until we catch up with each other. So the notion of wholeness is that we can become very whole in a very bad way. So it's incumbent upon us to take the wholeness index as a tool. This is not a pat yourself on the back and say, oh, you're at 65, good job. This is we're at 65, which means we're not even. And, you know, one of the things that remains out there for the wholeness index, and it's kind of an abstract point, I mentioned earlier that a score of 100 means everybody's equal. What that literally means is every home costs the same amount of money, that every neighborhood has the exact same amount of crime. That's not a realistic goal. Now, is some improvement over 65 or 66 or 67 better? Yes. But we're still working methodologically in the back end to identify what a realistic expectation is for a city.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ted in Tyler. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
So much of this very, very important and complex issue depends on a couple of things. I think number one is the economics of the people, the businesses that would move into the areas that of the disadvantaged or in the areas where they don't see it as a very good risk. The hospitals, the grocery stores, the tools that you're talking about. So it really boils down to, number one, how much money can be made for a business investing in the south part of Dallas versus the same business building or buying land in the north part of Dallas. So it's an economic issue, very much an economic issue. And in the south part of Dallas, one of the things we can do to change what's going on or raise some neighborhood values and increase awareness about the condition of the neighborhood is to increase fatherhood. That's one thing that you haven't mentioned. I'm not sure if your institute even works with that, but when we add two incomes to a household, we're going to increase the level of quality of that neighborhood in general, family by family.
So just to clarify, Ted, I want to make sure we understand. You mean increased fatherhood, meaning fathers involved in their children, not people procreating just for the sake of being fathers.
Exactly. I mean real fatherhood. I don't mean just, procreation. I'm talking about two-parent households, two-income households, and I realize joblessness is a problem. However, joblessness is not going to go away, joblessness will be the same whether there is a two-parent household or not. The fact is, most people now have a job, and I think, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, one thing that the Institute cannot or probably has not dealt with is the breakdown of the family in the poor communities. The breakdown of the family is a probably number one issue in poverty.
Really, Ted, you make really interesting points. I want to make sure that we have a chance for Tim to respond. Thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, you bet.
So, yeah, thanks, Ted. You know, one thing we caution against is trying to find the root cause. Because we can say, well, you know, if we don't have houses, no one will be able to move in. And the business community, economic development community says, but if there's no place for people to shop and get groceries, why would they move here? And then the education community says, but if we don't have adequate schools, who's going to want to build? And so it's a vicious circle. What's important is that we pick a place and start and make sure that someone else is starting on another angle. Now, this notion of the breakdown of the American family is important on a number of dimensions. I think the most hot button of those dimensions is this notion of, you know, that it's some type of a value judgment. But Ted, you hit the nail on the head. To some extent, it's an issue of income. It's an issue about bringing extra money into a family that can provide some stability, that can keep us from having to move from apartment to apartment based on a free rent situation. This is an issue that is very, very real for the Dallas Independent School District. Having children move throughout the district during the school year as families try and capitalize on rent agreements that allow them to, you know, make another month's worth of rent available somewhere down the road. So that's an important piece. Now, we do some work with an organization called Vision Regeneration and a number of others that have begun looking at this concept of youth culture. There's some very early academic research in the 70s and 80s that looked at this notion of the code of the streets and how you had some very real changes in people's mindset that would be, you know, this notion of a future orientation that many of us take for granted. That, you know, I know my kids are worried about, maybe worrying is too strong a term, but they recognize that they've got to think about college. They recognize that they've got to think about a career. They're not ready to make that decision, but they have that on the horizon. But there are some neighborhoods where the culture is so shifted that that's not an issue, that it's almost a negative. You're viewed as weak if you're worried about tomorrow. How you address that and how you fix that gets into issues like mass media. It gets into issues like music. It gets into issues like culture and church. That's not a very easy thing for an academic institute to step into, but we're not a typical academic institute. We started out as part of a nonprofit organization, so we have a little bit of leeway coming in. We have an academic arm. And we also have an engagement arm, and that engagement arm is very focused on how do we take the work of the Institute and other scholars, not just the work that we do, and make it real for people so it can be translated into solutions. We know that two-income families are important. We know that that a culture of violence is very dangerous. That's fine and dandy. What does a pastor in a church in East Dallas do on Sunday about that? What does a teacher in sixth grade in Pleasant Grove do with that information? And that's a very real question that we're dedicated to working on.
You spoke earlier, Tim, about the fact that we all, no matter what our personal values are and where we come from, we tend to apply our own framework for things to the way we assess other people's behavior and the choices that they've made. How, as a sociologist, where do you draw the line? Because it sounds like, and it makes sense to me, that when you say we have to find a way to make sure that people in lower income neighborhoods, lower education neighborhoods, recognize the value of education. But how is it that you're able to decide that is something that no matter what, everyone can sort of agree that this is important, as opposed to the decisions where we might think graffiti is a problem and other people in the neighborhood look at it as a piece of art? When do you decide that your perception is absolutely correct?
When there's one, right. And this gets back to, you know, one of the age-old debates about your rights extend as far as you know, your right to act extends as far as my right to be safe, this very early notion. I don't know that there is an easy answer. Sometimes, you know, it comes out of ignorance. That's happened to me. When we lived in Springfield, Illinois for 4 years, one night I'm taking the trash out. It's very dark at night. And I notice that there's a car down the street running with its lights off. Out of my neighbor's backyard comes running a body, all dressed in black, carrying a big bag, runs down. This car comes up the street. They dive in the car and they take off. Now, I was certain I had just witnessed at least a burglary and in my mind, probably all sorts of other horrible things. Well, it turns out that it was a prank night. I mean, it's been going on for decades in Springfield, and the kids go back and forth and steal each other's lawn ornaments. Now, that's a very simple example of just not knowing and believing that it means this, that, or the other thing. It's sort of, it was my own cultural ignorance. Now, if part of that ritual was to beat the tar out of somebody on the way, that's probably not a cool ritual to have.
The
right?
buck stops there.
Yeah, the buck, but how do you make that decision? You know, I think one of the things that happens is that as a society, as we have grown, we've industrialized. We codify things. We make rules. This was, one of the impetuses for the onset of community policing was allowing police departments to handle things differently from community to community with community input. Now, it turns out police departments often handle things differently from community to community. That community input piece is not always there, right? So we're making sure we're lined up with community priorities. How you establish those priorities, I don't think we have an answer for. I think it begins with dialogue. It begins with conversation. It begins with just a willingness to say, maybe this isn't right. Maybe this isn't what I think it is. As folks go to the state fair for this last week of the state fair, I always ask people to think about, when you get off the highway, do you feel unsafe? And why? Why is it that you feel unsafe? Maybe there's a very valid reason. Maybe the reasons aren't. And really only we know that inside of our own heads. How much of it is stereotypical perceptions or projections of what I think, or I heard that South Dallas was dangerous. But, 30,000 folks live there and call it home. It's not that, right? There's something more to it than that. So I wish I could say that, if we just used Plan B, we'd have it all taken care of. But I think it begins with an open and honest dialogue about what we do, why we do it, and how we create those rules as a society.
So this report gets published online?
Yes. The report itself will be on our website. We're doing something a little bit differently this year in a more ecologically friendly way. This was a 20-page report. It was only going to get larger this year. What we found a way to do is hand out a 2-pager at tomorrow's conference that gives you the heads up of what's going on. What we'll have up on our website is the ability to look at the different maps. One of the big criticisms is, the maps are so small in the book that you don't have the roads on them. So unless you know that you live in this little green area over here, you have no idea where your neighborhood is. So there'll be some way for folks to interact with those maps. Now, in mid-December, we're hoping to launch our next version of Dallas Indicators. It's called DFW IDEA. IDEA stands for Information Drives Empowered Action, where you'd be able to actually go to your neighborhood, go to your address, and find out what your neighborhood looks like.
Great stuff. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Dr. Timothy Bray is director of the Institute for Urban Policy and Research at the University of Texas at Dallas. They hold their annual conference tomorrow. You can find information about that on our website. It's been great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.